accession number 23377, reel 2.
So things did continue to deteriorate. When did you become interested in a military life, for instance? Had you been involved with things like the Boy Scouts with
oh, yes,
militia and things like that?
Not in the militia. From a fairly young age, I suppose when I was 10, 11, I joined the Boy Scouts then, and I used to have a whale of a time with the Scouts. We had a very innovative sort of bloke as far as the Scouts were concerned, and he whipped up enough of the parents to make it a good organisation, and it was very successful at that time. The war broke it up to a great degree, but that was the only organisation that I had joined as that. But we were living at Kelmscott at the time, and that was still a country area. It wasn't a
now suburb. A suburb of Perth.
Oh, that's right, yes, now a suburb. But it was still country, wide open country. We used to wander the hills and shoot rabbits and that sort of thing. When you could pick up sufficient money to buy a couple of bullets and go out and shoot rabbits, you know, that sort of thing. But militarily, no, I never had any.
You were 16 or thereabouts when the war broke out. What do you recall of the outbreak? The announcement, leading up to the announcement.
Oh, well, the announcement itself was quite a dramatic thing. I don't know whether Mr. Menzies looked on that as a time to do such a dramatic announcement, but being the sort of person he was prone to do that. But yes, it was a highly dramatic moment, and even then, as a kid, I felt shivers run down my spine when it you know, feel the hairs lifting on the back of your scalp, because it had been floating around for some time, but here it was. It was war, and we were involved. That was quite dramatic.
Do you remember the some of the words that stick in your mind from that occasion?
I've never forgotten them. As a matter of fact, it is my melancholy duty, and that was, you know, drama in itself to come out with words like that tell you that a state of war now exists between England and Germany, and Australia is joining in. So there we are, now we've got it. You know, it's been leading up some time with the business with Chamberlain going backwards and forwards, and in Australia we'd had a tightening of things. We had a fairly prominent sort of Italian community, and that Italian community, of course, was very worried. There was also a case of, I can't remember his name. He was an Austrian, I think, but he was a professor, a doctor, and goodness knows what. I can't recall his name, but he was coming out to, wanted to migrate to Australia. He got here on a ship, And they spent months proving that he wasn't a fit person. He passed all the tests, but then they gave him a test in some very remote language from the Himalayas or somewhere, and of course it was merely a thing to kick him out. But that was the sort of thing that was going on. They were all pointers, but it was being taken very seriously. In some cases, of course, it wasn't quite so serious. The army had taken on, they wanted vehicles, wanted a lot of vehicles. And of course, there were things that had to be done. All the dams, Canning Dam had just been opened up at that time, or in use. Mundaring and a couple of other dams had been looked at as possible points of sabotage. So they put the militia up there to look after these dams, and they had these blokes on board. They didn't have any motor transport of any consequence. So they offered to hire trucks, 3-ton trucks and that sort of thing, and anybody and everybody who had a truck pushed them forward to the army, and they took the lot. And we used to see these people going up to Canning Dam, because they used to go past our place out in Kelmscott along Albany Highway, going up to these various dams. And these blokes on the back of these trucks, they were just sitting there on forms on the back of the truck. And then somebody would take a wrong turning. Somebody at the front didn't quite know the way, and they'd take a wrong turning. And these blokes would go round and round until somebody put on the right track. It was quite humorous, really, but I suppose it was pretty serious problems that were, yeah, that were occurring.
Well, the war, presumably, must have seemed quite a far.
Oh, it was, yeah. Mm.
Was it something that did this? In what way did it alleviate the sort of pressure at home in Australia, do you think?
It created a lot of work. There were a lot of people, of course, enlisted immediately. There was a big enlistment force, they were sent very early in the piece over into the Middle East. That's where the first of them went.
How eager were you to get involved?
Of course, I was underage at the time, and I couldn't get involved very much. And I had just finished the junior exam at Perth Boys and failed that, so I was at home working. We had an orchard at the time, and I was at home giving Dad a hand. He wasn't in too good a health. But the war seemed a long way away, mainly because there was the war was a pretty distant thing. It was the time of the what they called the phony war, where the Maginot Line and the Siegfried Line were matching up to each other and were supposedly absolutely impregnable. They couldn't drive a tank across the top of them. They couldn't do this. They couldn't do that. So in that period, it was almost laughable, some of the moves that were made with the troops going across from England across into Belgian territory and into France and that sort of thing, and blacks being in the Maginot Line, and it was almost stalled. the course until the blitzkrieg came and he went around the top end of it. Finished that. That was the end of the phony war bit.
Up until that time, what sort of propaganda were you exposed to as a young bloke?
Lots of it as far as joining up was concerned. There was stacks of it around, and there were as youngsters we used to, of course, there was always a weekly dance down at the local hall, and we used to get throngs of like gathered down there, and of course as some of the local people enlisted, etc., and they came home and leave, and over that dance around the hall with all the local girls, etc., and it was seen as quite a thing that if you were in uniform, there were plenty of girls you could dance with, you know, that sort of thing. The radio, there was always propaganda on the radio, or the wireless was known in those days, and the in the paper there were always ads. Then of course you get posters that were around the place that extolling the virtues of being in the Army or the Navy or the Air Force and that sort of thing. So yes, there was quite a lot of propaganda around as far as particularly at that time, because they were although they weren't terribly short of volunteers, they were getting all they wanted, really.
And brother was in the Navy. What was he telling you about the experience that he was having?
Well, they went very shortly after the commencement of the war. He was on a destroyer, on the Voyager, and that there was four of them: Voyager, Beta, the Vampire, Waterhemp, and the Stuart. Five of them. They went straight over to the Mediterranean, and they were over there pretty well from the start of the war. So we never had much contact with him. He used to write letters, but of course the letters were either blacked out or the bits cut out of them and that sort of thing. So you could only assume quite a lot of it, because he could only talk in general terms. But
what was your impression of the whole show as a 16, 17-year-old?
Time for us to get into it. You know, we shall. That was sort of the way that
people talk of putting their age up just so that they can get in. Was that something that you were able to consider at all?
No, I never worried about it, because I was on the verge of it anyway, and I was still 17 when I went down and joined up, and were signed on the dotted line.
Tell us about that. What did you understand you were signing?
Oh, for hostilities only. That was the length of time you were signing up for, and that was to do as you were told in the Navy, or whatever they wanted you to do.
Why had you decided to join the Navy?
Oh, more or less following my brother, more than anything.
Why had he decided to go from the country, presumably inland, to join a naval experience?
Well, he worked as a young bloke. He'd worked a few years in a shop in Perth, and he's a bit of a restless sort of bloke, and he didn't take to it too kindly. He tolerated it, but eventually I was talking to some of the blokes that were living in Armidale, and they were in the Navy, and that of course there was quite a lot of competition just pre-war to get into the Navy, and you had to be pretty well on the ball to get in. And he went and applied. He got in. And he was very wrapped in the Navy, and was very happy with it, and like the donkey, I just followed on, I guess. But at the time that I enlisted, my eldest brother, he had been working in the mines up in Kalgoorlie, and he came down, and we both went down to Fremantle to enlist in the Navy. But he was too old for the Navy, they wouldn't have him, which disgusted him mightily. So he finished up, he joined the Army, and he finished up in the 2nd Force, so we both finished up in the same problem anyway. So
Well, tell us, what was involved in joining up, to join the Navy? What sort of tests did you have to endure?
Nothing. only thing was a medical test. There was no written test. All you had to do was to fill in a form, and there was no examination as far as your scholastic abilities were concerned, so long as you were healthy, etc. And medical test was pretty basic. They just checked your blood pressure, felt your pulse, and then grabbed a handful and said cough, and that was about your medical test, you know. That was about all that was required.
Do you know of any people that were keen not to get involved?
No, I possibly there were one or two that were around the place, but not really. I can't recall.
How would they have been seen?
Oh, well, that was the days when there were still white feathers floating around, and that wasn't a very nice thing as far as I was concerned. If a bloke didn't want to be in it, well, then that's his business, not anybody else's. So some of that was around, and it was a very disconcerting thing to hear about, let alone have any knowledge of it, really. Because on one occasion, this brother of mine was in the Navy. He came home, it was after he came home from the Mediterranean. They'd had a pretty worrying time, but over there, and when he came back, he was walking in towards the railway station in Perth, but he'd taken off his uniform and he was just in civilian clothes. And he had a white feather. So it was a very dangerous thing to do. He just laughed it off. But that was the sort of thing that did occur. But generally the people accepted, well, if you want to go, you go. If you don't want to go, well, then you've got to buckle to and do something. Yeah. And that was generally what happened with people who didn't want to go. They were put into some sort of occupation that was going to help the war effort anyway.
What was the news that you were hearing about the war, and how did it get to you? In what form did it come?
Via the newspaper and via the wireless. That was Dad had this wireless, and he it was a shortwave wireless, and he used to be able to pick up the BBC, and of course that as far as he was concerned was the absolute ultimate truth when it came through, because it came from that source. But it was a
How did the BBC present, for instance, the Dunkirk situation, the Blitzkrieg, as you mentioned earlier? How did they sort of portray that in relation to what was going on?
It was always watered down to some extent, whether it was when it came to the retreat down to when the British were trying to get out of Belgium and off the north of France, etc. That was the heroic part of it was always to the fore more than the idiotic idea of putting people in there in the first place when there was going to be retreats and that sort of thing.
What did people generally feel, do you think, when they saw just how powerful the Germans were?
I got very worried, of course, because when this first Blitzkrieg thing came through, that was awesome, the way they did it. It was brutal, but it was quite awesome. If you're going to fight a war, that's results of what counts. And that was the general acceptance of the Blitzkrieg part of it.
France was to sign an armistice with Germany on the 22nd of June. What were your feelings about that situation?
Well, that was absolutely a failure, and perhaps was to be expected, but it was still a monumental problem from there on. That was going to be.
Battle of Britain begins on the 10th of July. What was the feeling that Britain might actually be invaded at that point, do you think?
Well, I think most people were very surprised that it wasn't invaded. Now, what persuaded Hitler to go in the other direction, whatever it was the saviour as far as Britain being invaded is concerned. That was a good escape, I guess, as much as anything.
How the Italians had come in on the side of the Germans, how was that seen in relation to the fact that there were quite a few Italians living in Australia at the time? You mentioned that the Italian community was a bit worried about that whole situation. How was it seen when they entered the war? The Axis force.
They were a nuisance value. That was the attitude as much as anything. They were a nuisance value because they were going to be a problem as far as controlling the Mediterranean area was concerned. That was their biggest the biggest problem as far as the Italians having them in the war was concerned. Not terribly effective, but they had high nuisance value. Their soldiery wasn't particularly good, and the Navy had big ships, and big ships with big guns can cause an awful lot of damage without getting too far involved. But the bloke that put paid to the Italians, of course, was Cunningham, the British Admiral. He was the bloke that settled their hash. He sent in the torpedo bombers into Taranto and settled a lot of the fleet on the bottom there. So that was a very big blow as far as the Italians were concerned.
What was the prestige in being in the Navy as opposed to another force like the Army or the Air Force?
nothing very much as far as I was concerned. It was just merely that John was in the Navy. It was a good proposition, and we had always been very close, and it was always accepted that once you'd been in the Navy for a certain length of time, you could claim brothers. In other words, I could be on the same ship as him. Whether that was going to be an advantage or a disadvantage, of course, it remains to be seen. But we never got to that point.
So when were you called up?
On the 27th of January 1941.
And what was the feeling when that happened?
Oh, fine. That was, at least we're doing something, we're on our way, we know, where we're going, etc., etc.
How do you think your parents saw that now they have two sons in the Navy?
Mum, of course, was a bit heartbroken about the whole thing, but very accepting of the fact that it was perhaps better to go and do the fighting somewhere else than what it was to let the fight come here.
Was that seen as a reality, that if it wasn't stopped, it would eventually come here?
Oh, yes.
The Germans would come to Australia?
Yeah. Mm. That was seen as quite a valid point. Although Hitler at the time only had eyes or designs on Europe, he also had his eyes on Africa. And because the French also had Algeria at the time, when France went over to under German domination, Algeria would follow, that was the worry, that it would continue on down through there, because there was also some old scores to settle with Turkey, and world domination, of course, was his final solution as far as they were concerned. So yes, there was very much a thought that it was better to go over there and do your fighting on somebody else's doorstep than what it does to have it happen here.
You mentioned that you were to be called up on the 27th of January 1941, and at that time the Australians had been quite successful against the Italians in North Africa. How was that all seen?
Oh, as a very good result, because it was freeing up, going to free up men, and it was going to free up areas of country, etc., so that it could be otherwise utilised, or it was quite an expensive operation being in the desert, because distances and casualty as far as machinery and equipment was concerned, it was always very difficult because of the sand, etc. So yes, it was at that time right, we knock the eye ties out of it, and it's not quite so bad. But of course, when the Germans came into it in Africa, that was a different story. That was a completely different operation. But as far as the Italians were concerned, because they surrendered in such vast numbers, you're talking about how we got the news on a lot of these things. One of the other items of communication was newsreel films at the picture theatre. And, of course, a lot of people used to go to the pictures, movies, call them what you like, in those days, and there was always a movie time news, or the latest aspects of the war, whether it was done by one firm or the other, and that we used to love portraying these great long streams of Italian prisoners and maybe half a dozen Australians looking after thousands of prisoners, really, and just these, and just quite nonchalantly marching along the road. They made a big effort of that, or a big thing of it.